process of mentalization and empathic resonance sharing in this reflective network. And that, again, includes the teacher, the therapist, and the child patient. The child really begins to experience the process of learning to trust, which is absolutely foundational, right? And begins to count on being valued, begins to count on being listened to, held in mind, you know, reflected back to, and ultimately really cared about and loved.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This is a podcast in which we will discover the world of psychoanalysis that lives beyond the couch, beyond the individual consultation room. We will meet psychoanalysts who work in dialysis units, prenatal clinics, corporate boardrooms, community centers, humanitarian organizations, and with vineyard workers, just to name a few. We hope these conversations expand our awareness of how broadly psychoanalytic thinking extends into our communities. Come listen, enjoy, and please share your comments on the webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Catherine McCormick. Catherine McCormick is an advanced psychoanalytic candidate in both child and adult at the Seattle Psychoanalytic Society and Institute. She holds a master's in psychology, is a licensed marriage and family therapist, a child mental health specialist, and an ethnic minority mental health specialist in the state of Washington for American Indian and Alaska Natives. Catherine has worked for over 20 years on the Tulalip Tribes Reservation in the state of Washington as a clinician, and also for the past 10 years as the administrative clinical supervisor of the Child, Youth, and Family Mental Wellness Program. For the past 3.5 years, she has been the administrative clinical supervisor of the Betty J. Taylor Early Learning Academy, which is the tribe's Birth to Five Center for Behavioral Health and Recovery. Well, if all these things weren't enough, Catherine is also the president of IPSO. IPSO is the International Psychoanalytic Studies Organization, which is the IPA's organization for psychoanalytic candidates. This is an organization with over 2,000 members worldwide in over 42 countries. As you will hear in today's conversation, Catherine is deeply devoted to the well-being of the Tulalip tribe members. She is deeply involved in what's called reflective network therapy, which is a psychoanalytically informed treatment approach developed by Dr. Gilbert Kleiman that is especially suited, Catherine feels, to the tribal community. And we're going to learn a great deal more about this important modality. And in addition to that, she's also very involved in the work with IPSO. So this is a very busy and talented and thoughtful woman, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. Catherine, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on board. Catherine, when people think of psychoanalytically informed approaches to clinical work, they don't generally associate that with the Native American population. They seem to exist in people's minds in two different worlds. And yet, you've been working with the Tulalip tribe for 20 years or so, and you've been very meaningfully working with the analytically informed reflective network therapy, RNT, which was developed by the psychoanalyst Gilbert Kleiman. Now, I'm embarrassed to say that I hadn't heard of reflective network therapy until I met you and started learning about your work. So I'm eager to learn more about it, and I suspect many in our audience also don't know about it. So we will spend some time on that today, but before doing so, can you tell us a little bit about the population that you've been working with, what the community is like, what the kinds of clinical challenges you face are?
Yes, thank you, first of all, for the interview And I work in a community whose members have been betrayed by broken treaties, massacres, and very old traumas. And these wounds are essentially being transmitted transgenerationally. And it really has been through the forced and systematic process of decolonization and the many things that happened afterwards up to present time that included folks, people having their children being taken and put into boarding schools and forcibly removed in this process, wherein they lost their song, their dance, their language, their culture. They were forbidden and severely punished. So that's in some ways to look at that there is there has been a pretty systemic and systematic genocide of tribal peoples, very similar in many respects to what happened in the Holocaust. So there are a number of parallels that have been actually quite thoroughly researched in more recent times. So that is the backdrop that's important to hold in mind when thinking about working in tribal communities in general.
How big a community is it currently, the tribe you work with?
Roughly about 5,000. And that includes, you know, the babies all the way up to the elders. Okay. Roughly about 5,000. Yeah.
And what kind of clinical presentations do you see in your clinic?
Well, I see a lot of trauma. We see neglect, abuse of different sorts and forms, and we see developmental delays and disorders as well as behavioral acting out, behavioral conditions and situations for the reasons why initially we generally get a referral. So we see a wide range of things, and there's often the intersectionality of multiple struggles that the little ones that we work with have. So there's a range, a very big range.
And is there an interest in mental health care? Are they open to the services that you have to offer? Or is part of what you do part of a convincing job that this would be useful for them?
Actually, it's really been very well received, which is something I thought initially when I heard about reflective network therapy through Dr. Kleiman. I met him many years ago at a training he did in Seattle using the model. And the community has been very open into receiving it. And I think part of that, or a lot of that, has to do with that I've been in the community for over 20 years, but really the actual model is based on networks. Familial and community and interpersonal networks, which is very syntonic with tribal ways of being in the world, generally speaking, and understanding just different world views, perhaps, and different ways of relating. That's very instrumental in tribal communities still to this day.
It speaks a common language.
Absolutely a common language, I think. And that I think that's one of the reasons why it's been so well received. And that also because we've had good success. So, I mean, of course, that really adds to it.
Well, can you teach us about RNT? Assume I know nothing about it, which isn't far from the truth. Can you tell us a little bit about the background thinking? I understand mentalization is key to it, and certainly your ongoing presence in the classroom is part of it, but share with us a tutorial, if you will.
Certainly. So reflective network therapy, also known as RNT, as you mentioned, was developed over 50 years ago by Dr. Gilbert Kleiman, who's a psychoanalyst. He's also a forensic psychiatrist, child psychiatrist. And the method, I guess we could say the method, the way it works and how it works to the very beginning of RNT is that it is a psychoanalytically informed method. It was developed, I mentioned, 50 years ago in about 1965, and to date has, I think, helped more than 1,900 children that are either developmentally and emotionally disabled. And some of these children may include foster kids. In fact, many have included foster children that are affected by trauma, abuse, again, or neglect, behavioral concerns, as I mentioned. But this process of the reflective therapy and treatment network has really been shown to be very helpful, very instrumental in helping these children who otherwise have been through these traumas like DV, domestic violence, or having to move from one family to the other, to basically heal and have a different pathway. Part of the work, which is a little bit different, is that we do baseline testing with the WPC-4, which is a cognitive testing at baseline. And then about a year in, we also do another test. So we can have a pre and post. And generally speaking, there's often been shown in the data that we have, and this is independent of Tulalip where I work, it's often been shown to have about a 2-point increase, or, you know, that's 2 standard point increase, excuse me, so I don't mean 2 points, a 15 point increase or 2 standard deviations increase, which is pretty phenomenal.
In the IQ test, you're saying?
In the IQ test,
yeah, yes. That's what I was reading, right.
Yes.
Very impressive.
Right. So the way the method works is that this method does include psychoanalysts or therapists and educators working together and learning from each other, and that is one of the networks. So the process is that the child is in the classroom in a play session for maybe about 20 minutes at a time every school day that they're there. And before the therapy session, the teacher briefs the child and the therapist about what the child's been doing in class and at home, let's say. For instance, often maybe a parent or caregiver who's just dropped off the child might say something like, you know, Johnny had a bad dream, or Johnny said a whole lot of new words yesterday that we didn't know he could say, you know, or he started to read, or he got into trouble, or he had a problem with this or that. And at that point, the teacher then takes a couple short minutes to condense that information when, say, our therapists come in or I come in, let's say. And after maybe about the 20-minute, again, play therapy session, the child, in this case the patient, and the therapist does the same thing in reverse, which means that we debrief the teacher. For instance, we might say something like, let's see, like Johnny has been playing with dogs and cats, and the cats had babies, and Johnny seemed to be upset about the cats having babies. And the teacher hears that because the teacher is part of the debriefing as well as the child. And then these debriefings and debriefings build on each other. They build on the specific interactions and themes that the child is experiencing. And then it kind of goes into the idea of mentalization, which, yeah.
Well, please say more about that piece of it.
Right. So through, it's basically the process of mentalization and empathic resonance sharing in this reflective network. And that, again, includes the teacher, the therapist, and the child patient. The child really begins to experience the process of learning to trust, which is absolutely foundational, right? And begins to count on being valued, begins to count on being listened to, held in mind, you know, reflected back to, and ultimately really cared about and loved. So during this process, other children, because this is done, and again, in the classroom, are allowed to help in each session, classmates, in other words. For example, the children that are not participating, you know, not the identified patient, let's say, but they often really become quite big helpers, the other children do, and rather altruistic. And for instance, say a child who has special needs, you know, doesn't know how to play very well, then the other children help that child. And they'll help the child learning, you know, how to talk and behave, let's say. So that's the process generally. And then weekly, what's also different about this model is that parents or caregivers also get together with a teacher or the therapist and then share information about the child. In that process, they brief and also debrief each other. And this, again, furthers establishing what the community healing is for the community and the school
and
the child.
It models a certain kind of attentiveness, I would imagine.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. It does.
Now, do you intervene on a family basis? Will you make observations about dynamics and tensions in the family as this debriefing happens, or is it just to inform them about what's going on with the child?
Well, generally, right, like with all types of work that we do in the sense of therapy, just in basic therapy, let alone in analytic work, and working in a community such as this, it's about relationship building, and it's a relational process and dynamic. And so if something comes up within the family, as the trust is built, generally a family, you know, would be sharing with us what is going on and what they're observing and what they're, you know, what other things are contributing to what's happening in the classroom. So they're very involved in the process. It's a real intensive and an integrated model in that way.
The question I was wondering is whether, with that trust being built, whether the parents also feel receptive to anything you might point out about them that is impacting the patient, the child.
Absolutely. Yes, that is true. So if, the trust is already built and hopefully continuously built and solidified and consolidated between the caregiver, the parent, and the therapist, there is more of a trusting receptivity to, okay, this person is to be trusted. One of us is working with a child, patient as well. And so generally folks are, pretty open to hearing what we have to say, but it's like any kind of a process. It's done with, trust and timing and, sure. and the right moment really.
Yeah. Oh, as always, can you describe a case that you've worked with where this has all played out?
Yes. So we have worked, I'll just say, to date with over 15 children that have experienced quite a tremendous growth and healing. And a particular child that I'm thinking of is one that we worked with for just, I think it was just over 2 years. And when that child came to us, that child presented as very removed, very isolated, very tentative, very frightened, and very seemingly unattached, disinterested, and disconnected. That child would avert gaze, would not make any eye contact. And this was happening at home as well as with us in the school, as well as with me indirectly, because this was a patient that I had. But this child would not make...
Was there a trauma history?
Yes, significant trauma history, multiple abuses and neglect, and repeated removals. Until the child did land with family where the child still lives today and is doing quite well. But during this process, it took, I want to say, about 4 months or so for the child to begin to tolerate my presence. And at one point, there was a classmate who was interested in this child and wanted to have some contact with this child. And this child, prior to this, was not having contact with any of the kids, was very removed, did not interact well at all with anyone. And this one day, this classmate had an injury and wasn't in school this particular day. And when this child returned a couple days later, this patient that I'm referencing immediately not only lit up, but announced who had left and why they had left, had interest in the other, had a relational context. And instead of then beginning to tolerate this child with kind of more of a parallel play, allowed the child a more of a collaborative stance, which took again a few more months after that. But there were different sort of points where it was so clear that we'd turned the corner yet again. And yeah, this child has done remarkably well and is thriving today. So there's quite a few different stories that I could tell, but this was a remarkable case, as actually many of them have been.
Sure. That's a lovely example. And I don't know if that's the patient described on the video. That's going to be included with the notes, but I would recommend.
That is the patient. Because this is a patient where there's been permission given.
Yes. Of course.
Absolutely.
I would recommend for those interested to read the notes and go to the links, because they're very moving and very important. One of the things that, of course, comes up as I speak to analysts who are doing work similar to yours in venues really around the world is finances. And what you are describing sounds very rich in the sense that you're providing really profound services, but it seems very labor intensive. That is, the ratio of therapists of various sorts to each child seems very high. Am I reading that right?
Well, potentially, but actually it's a little different than maybe how it sounds initially, because although it is a very rich and integrated process, the therapist is in the classroom, as you mentioned, doing the intensive work. However, these are billable services. And so this is actually a very financially sustainable treatment, because the services are fairly short duration and they occur generally several times a week, 3 to 4 times a week. In this case, it's 4 times a week, but it's a high intensity, but a highly billable service. And there is no transportation costs involved whatsoever, because the child is available. So there's high retention rate. It's a billable service. And the that we've had very little recidivism or very little dropout rate because the families see the benefit. They're very engaged in the process. And so it's really been a plus where so many other intensive, say, or even just child-centered therapies, especially those that are done in the classroom, you know, may not be as well received or may not be sustained, or even those that are done, of course, outpatient have a much more harder time.
Sure. It really sounds like such a powerful match.
Yes.
Between the RNT system and the receptivity of the children, the families, the community at large. It's very special. And do you think it would be applicable in other settings?
Most definitely. It's been already done in more, well, I'm trying to get the numbers correctly. I want to say it's in 10 different sites with, 26 different teams of therapists. So it's been done actually in two continents, including actually in Buenos Aires, Argentina. So there have been a number of programs, and we have currently quite a few more sites that are at this present moment looking to join in.
It's so, very exciting,
yes.
Including that my understanding is that there's outcome research that
most definitely
demonstrates the effectiveness. So
yes, we will be giving a link for that as well.
Great. Wonderful. Okay. Two other questions I want to get to. I mentioned in the introduction that you're, in addition to all these activities, you're also the current president of IPSO, the IPA Organization for Psychoanalytic Candidates. But before we get to that, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background. What brings you to this work in Washington State? Something that you could look at in yourself and make sense of this commitment that you have, other than its obvious worthwhileness?
Right. Take a breath here for a moment. I guess I would definitely say it's really through my mother's ancestry that in part drew me to this work. I'm part Mohawk and Delaware through my mother. And I grew up learning and hearing about real significant prejudice and internalized racism that she identified with and endured. Both, I guess you could say, as a repudiation, idealization, and sometimes an ambivalence as far as in her tribal identity. And so that is definitely something that played into essentially my initially coming to the community, I'm sure. You know, back then there were these postings that were very common in laws back when my mother was growing up. Some of the postings were, again, very common, sadly, such things as like, you know, no Indians or dogs allowed. The only good Indian is a dead Indian, you know. So she really experienced just so much shame and hardship and ostracization. So I kind of took that in as a young child. And I, through that process, began to really understand some of the intersectionalities, I guess we could say, of isms and things that she endured. And so I felt, you know, a real strong desire to kind of, I'm sure, do some reparative work on that for my own self. Watching her process and just how it took her such a while to become who she is today. And then also my father, I know I drew upon that as well. He was a civil rights attorney and he specialized in immigration and constitutional law, kind of in the local, national, and the international scene. And so I really grew up in a politically aware and active, really diverse and vibrant kind of multi-generational household. And so I was drawn to working groups from a really early age, and I guess you could say with Native Americans in particular. So there's that background. And then really how I ended up in doing analytic work and actually in that main way of actually doing even RNT is that while I was doing the intensive clinical work at, again, real higher session frequencies, and this was an analysis, but it was just working intensively with the kids and adolescents at the time, I really began to experience, I guess what we would definitely say is reparative work, that it was possible. I began to understand, I guess we could say, almost like an intrinsic healing that could happen in the process of being lost and found. There were so many painful realizations of really, I could see that what was happening in psychic splits and other kind of disorganized states, you know, of attachment, ambivalent, avoidant, and so forth. And kind of what happens when there is neglect, violence, and traumas of all parts, you know, body, mind, spirit, psyche, soul, all of it. And during that process, I really began to get a sense of what the costs are, what the survival value of defenses are, and what is needed for repair. So in that process of watching this, you know, this, you could say it was like an, it was a, how to describe it. It was a sort of a developmental need and a sort of like this anxiety experience that a lot of the adolescents were playing out by hiding when I first, you know, would get them out in the lobby. And I watched this over and over. It became sort of repetitive and it became kind of a ritualistic process. But I began to understand that that was also the reparative, that this was essential. And so in that need for replaying that, I began to get a sense that this was perhaps really developing and relaying what I guess we would call almost like a foundation of trust. Maybe even as I came to understand this later, kind of like a restructuring of maybe epistemic trust, you know, that builds an epistemic knowledge, kind of like what Peter Fonagy has been doing a lot of research with. You know, how do we have, any of us have a sense of safety and a secure attachment? You know, what do we need to have a coherent narrative and a coherent self-structure for that matter?
And that's what drew you to psychoanalytic work.
Absolutely. And what happened is I was attending an international play therapy conference, and I kind of stumbled upon some play therapy themes that were being described in real time in a practical application of by a number of theoreticians. And I delved into reading a number of theoreticians, developmental theoreticians and those that were doing attachment work. And it sort of went from there. I mean, I have a lot of different folks that I began to read and try to understand way before I even applied the analytic program. Yeah.
And I imagine your work as an analyst has deepened your sense of how all this applies.
Yes.
Let me ask you to put on that other hat for a moment, the Ipso hat. Tell us about the work that you've been doing, what the organization does and what you're doing as a president. This is an organization of over 2,000 members around the world of psychoanalytic candidates.
Yes. So as you mentioned, IPSO, I'll just explain what it stands for. I can't remember if you've already said that, but it's the International.
No.
Yeah, IPSO stands for the International Psychoanalytic Studies Organization. And we are essentially the candidates organization of the IPA. And you mentioned we have over 2,000 members. I think it's like 2,072 or something. And we are active, as you mentioned, in 42 countries. I was specifically drawn to IPSO, I guess many years ago now, to really expand my own analytic base and connection with international involvement. And really the drive for me had been to know more about and to learn more of the, quote, off-the-couch work that was available, that was happening because of my work with the tribes, because that just makes sense. And I actually really think about this before I get into specifics about IPSO, is that, as we know, you know, psychoanalysis really got its start with Freud, who didn't only treat, you know, the well-healed, you know, he had really began to do the work with thinking outside the box, I think, and working with those that really had suffered great hardship and loss. And I think about now, our world is so much more complicated than it is before. And so there are so many intersectionalities that we as analysts and candidates can draw upon. So I think how this applies to candidates specifically is that, of course, we are not just the future, but we're the present of the IPA. And the world demands and the world requires and the world offers so many possibilities of work with off-the-couch type thinking. You know, one thing is to hold the frame, right? And I think, okay, our theories are the ones that help us hold the frame, but we always have to remain flexible with the application of techniques and the delivery of analysis, and, you know, using our analytic thinking is always part of that process.
And it's a fascinating tension you just outlined that I have been learning about in these podcasts with colleagues from around the world, the tension between the frame and the flexibility. And one always needs that tension, even in the office with a standard analysis, but you also need it even more so when the frame has to be something you carry with you, as some,
yes,
some colleagues have,
yes,
put it. And IPSO is involved in this how?
Right. So IPSO,
what kind of activities?
Yes. So we are involved in this because we are in, again, so many countries in the world. We have conferences and we have IPSO days and we have panels and we have congresses. We have so many different activities that are done regionally. It's almost like each region, and that would be North America, Latin America, and Europe. And there are many countries that also fall under those somewhat arbitrary designations. But we are in the community. We have, for instance, coming up in May, just as an example of something currently, we have our first ever Ipsos Study Day that we're going to be having for Latin America. It's going to be held in Mexico City. And connected to that, we're also going to have another type of event that Ipsos has been sponsoring and helping sponsor for a few years now called Mensana in Corpore Sano, which basically means healthy mind, healthy body. And that is a two-day prior to the actual Ipsos Study Day. That's going to be a process of physically and spiritually and emotionally kind of connecting the body, psyche, trying to heal the split, the body, the soma, psyche split. And so there's different activities that we have prior to that, just as one example. So we do different types of actual analytic work. And the way I guess I mostly think about the off-the-couch process for Ipso itself is that we use, I don't know if I can say that, well, we don't currently have, that I'm aware of, we don't currently have that many candidates specifically, not as many, there are some candidates, let me back that up. There's some candidates involved in off-the-couch work, but I think we can have more because generally as candidates, I think what we generally do is we follow the frame until we feel like there, we can have some flexibility within the frame. And so I think there's room, if we look at the origins of psychoanalysis, I think, as well as present day, how it's applied in so many different places. And some of this is, I know, brought out in the podcast that now I'm part of, where we can see the application of theory and practice that are melded into one in some very unique ways. So I think there are many different ways that it can be done. I don't think
it's very exciting. And there will be links.
We will have numerous links.
Yes, that's terrific. Well, we've covered a lot of territory. We've covered the political history in the United States. We've covered clinical work. We've learned a little bit about reflective network therapy. Dr. Kleiman will be on an upcoming podcast to go into it even further. And we've learned about your background, and we've also learned about your work as an Ipso president. You are a very, very busy woman. And I'm grateful for your sharing your time and thoughts with us. And I'm grateful for the work you're doing and for what we could all learn from it. It's very vital. And it's not useful not only for the individuals and the families that you treat, but for the community at large. So I'm grateful.
Well, thank you so much. And I'm grateful and very pleased I could participate. Thanks again.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.